We almost have a quorum now. Hey, that's pretty good.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I'll just go off the slides.
I was going to go over.
Let's talk about it some more.
Yeah.
Let's talk about
these with you.
Okay.
Whatever.
All right. Okay. We're going to start now.
Well.
Okay. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order, and we have the great pleasure today to have an information meeting and hear from the chair of the Revenue Restructure Task Force, who was a previous chair of this committee when I had the privilege of serving on it with him. Absolutely wonderful chair, both for the committee and for the task force, former Representative Lane Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Again, for the record, Lane Shetterly. I'm an attorney in private practice over in Dallas. And for the past interim, it was my real honor to serve at the governor's request as chair of the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring created in House Bill 2530 last legislative session. We began meeting in November of 2007. We concluded with a meeting just earlier this year on January 8th, which we affectionately called December 39th, because we did want to be done by the end of 2008. And I'm pleased to be here this morning to present to you an overview of the task force's report with recommendations that we are bringing forward to the to this legislative session. I want to thank Mr. Chair and Representatives Reed and Representative Bruin, for their service on this task force. So I apologize to the three of you that a lot of this is going to be review, but I think it's important for the rest of the members of the committee and also for the assembly, for the public that may tune in or maybe read reports of this meeting, to get a sense of the big picture and what this task force did and what we are bringing to you and the basis on which we are bringing our recommendations to you this legislative session. I'll begin with a description of the task force, then I will outline the findings that the task force made regarding our revenue systems. And I say systems because we addressed both state and local revenue systems. We did not focus just on one or the other. Then I will discuss recommendations and how we expect will offer to be engaged with the legislature during this session and moving forward with the recommendations. The task force was created by House Bill 2530 last session. Those of you who were here had the opportunity to vote for that. And began with the thesis that Oregon needs a stable and adequate revenue system, addressing the state revenue needs, but also recognizing local governments have their own revenue issues as well. And so this task force was explicitly charged to look at both state and local revenue systems. There were 30 members of the task force. The bill that appointed the governor as chair, the governor prevailed on me at the beginning of the interim last interim, to serve as his designee. I'll tell you, it was not an immediate acceptance on my part. Having been through 7 years on the Revenue Committee and a couple of exercises on revenue reform, I think my initial response to the governor was, I've seen this movie and I know how it ends. But the governor did prevail on me with commitment of his personal involvement and interest in the task force. And I want to stop at this point just to say, express thanks to the governor because he maintained that level of involvement and interest and support for the task force. I briefed him during the course of the interim on the task force's workings, and we were pleased to have Tim Nesbitt participate in all of the task force meetings, even attended one of our road shows. Tim, Deputy Chief of Staff for the governor, is here even today, and I'm sure we'd be pleased to add his benediction at some point, Mr. Chair, if you want to bring him up, but that's up to you. But again, just a comment of thanks to the governor. I think one of the dangers of a task force like this is the legislature creates it and then it goes off and just kind of flounders and gets lost in the weeds and they don't even send out a search party to find it. it. But this really was not the case. The legislators who were involved were very deeply involved. The governor maintained involvement, and I think therein lies the secret of the success of this task force to a very large degree. I mentioned legislative participation, 4 senators and 4 representatives. The rest of the members of the task force were appointed by the governor, representing various perspectives, not only policy and political, but also geographical, business, labor, those kinds of perspectives, a very wide-ranging set of perspectives on the task force, and I think that also leads to the credibility of the recommendations that we bring forward. And the task force was supported by a 7-member advisory committee of tax attorneys, accountants, economists. That was the criteria in the bill. So it was a cast of not quite thousands, but it was a big cast anyway to carry this project through. My thanks to members of this committee who served on that, and all of the members. It was a very actively supported task force by its members who maintained a high level of involvement. In attending the various road shows around the state, which we had in Medford and Newport and Pendleton and Redmond and Eugene. So that is the makeup of the work group. We finished our report, and here we have, I want to start with the key findings. I will say that where we began this task force really was an examination of facts. We didn't begin with the recommendations on the plate. We began first several months worth of doing what you're doing now, and that is getting just a grounding in our revenue system. A lot of this will be a review for you, those of you particularly who have been on the committee before, but it's updated information, I think, that we bring forward, because we did spend a lot of time grounding the task force in the facts of our revenue systems so that we would have a solid foundation for our recommendations going forward. The key finding of the state revenue system, no surprise to you, but it bears repeating, is its dependence on the volatile personal income tax. We're seeing that in spades, of course, in this legislative session. How fast the income tax grows as a revenue source during strong economic times, and just how fast it falls during economic downturns. Interestingly, compared to that, the local revenue system has a completely different set of problems. It is a very stable system, dependent as it is primarily on the property tax for its general fund source, which is growing at the rate of 3% a year, a little bit more than that for exception value, but at a rate that is not keeping pace with the rate of inflation and the cost of doing business at the local government level. So there's no volatility at the local level. You don't have that problem. What you do have is a rate of growth in funding that is not keeping pace with the rate of cost of providing business and services at the local government level. So 2 different revenue systems, 2 different funding sources, and 2 completely different characteristics of them. Again, just some background here on our findings, and then I'll get to our recommendations. I won't take a lot of time with these, except these slides here, except to bring you up to speed on some of the things that we discovered. This slide illustrates the history of personal income tax and property tax revenue. You can see the income tax is more volatile than the property tax. That's really what this illustrates. Those downturns in the property tax line are accounted for by ballot measures. The first downturn in the early 90s into the mid-90s reflects the implementation of ballot measure 5 that reduced property tax rates to $15 per thousand, still tied to the market value in terms of the how we taxed property. So once ballot measure 5 had become fully implemented, it moved property taxes moved up again because the taxes were tied to market value. That brought on ballot measure 47, then ballot measure 50, which ratcheted that back down. And from there, we have a very stable and predictable rate of growth of property tax revenue. You can draw that line out just almost in perpetuity. The income tax, those peaks and valleys are reflective of economic conditions. This again illustrates what we just said about the differences between the state and local revenue systems and how they are, what they respond to. Again, you know this, but it's worth grounding our recommendations in, and that is the state's inordinate dependence on the personal income tax for its general fund revenue, and now we're talking about state taxes. If you look at the U.S. average, you can see a much more diversified source of funding. We are the most dependent on any single tax source of any state in the nation and the most dependent on the income tax. Interestingly, the mirror image of our revenue system is to the north of us, where Washington is the second most dependent on a single revenue source, and that, of course, is the sales tax. But this really shows how anomalous our revenue system is among the states, comparing us with the average. This one is the slide that I like to say really looks like a person in cardiac arrest. It is the history of volatility of the personal income tax changes from year to year. Probably the most recent and the most dramatic one you see there is the 03 recession, where the we dropped, that is, we declined in general fund revenue, personal income tax, 20%. And we'll see how that compares with other states in terms of volatility. Then you saw how quickly that rebounded. Again, a perfect illustration of the elasticity and the volatility of our income taxes. And now, again, that precipitous decline, and who knows where the bottom of that line is at the edge of the chart, but it's probably below what you're seeing there. Again, I mentioned that Washington is just an interesting comparator just because it's our mirror image and in the neighborhood. This is just for information purposes. It illustrates the relative volatility of our income tax-based system and Washington's sales tax-based system. This would be good. This is almost a feint. This would be good if we were leading into a discussion of sales tax as our recommendation. Let me just say right now, that's not where we're coming to you with the recommendation. This is just for illustration purposes. It's not intended to prime the pump. You saw that cardiac arrest chart. This shows it by the numbers in the 2001-2003 recession. If you take Alaska out of the picture, and it really doesn't compare well in terms of its revenue systems with other states, this shows that Oregon was hit hardest in by that 2001 recession, with a 20.3% decline in tax revenues. The worst in the nation, and by a significant degree. California next at 17.6, the average being 5.6 decline. Oregon was at 20.3. Again, that is a direct reflection on our dependence on the personal income tax as the main source of revenue for the state. So we know that the general fund is susceptible to influence of economic cycles. That's very clear in the numbers. But the task force also looked at the impact of voter initiatives on the state budget and revenues. Voter initiatives have a major impact as well. This slide illustrates what the title of it shows, that 50% of new spending since 1990 has been determined by voters through the initiative process. Let's go back there. The measures that are most implicated here, ballot measure 5, we'll see the precise illustration of that in the next slide, but that is the measure that reassigned the major share of support for the public school system in the state from local property taxes to the state general fund. It brought that into the state budget without bringing additional revenue with it. Measure 50, again, the follow-up to that on the property tax, and then Measure 11, the first victims' rights measure, the impact there being prison construction and then maintenance of the population and staffing. All of these measures having significant impacts on spending, not made by legislative decision, but made by voter initiative. This one illustrates how Measure 5, just one single initiative, has had an effect on the state budget, and it's then of course the impact on other things the state funds. Before 1995, 96, when Measure 5 was fully implemented, local property taxes accounted for about 70% of support for K-12 schools throughout the state. When Measure 5 reduced the property tax for schools to $5 per thousand, it included the directive in the measure that the state would make up the difference without any directive as to how the state would do that, without any revenue with which to fulfill that obligation. But you can see the effect there on the state general fund now, then having stepped in to fill that gap that was left in the school fund by the reduction of property taxes, so that now the state general fund is supporting 70%, and the property tax burden has been reduced to 30% in support of local schools. It was during the 1990s that we had that period of just really unprecedented sustained economic growth, which masked the impact of ballot measure 5 in that respect, because the state was able to do that. We had phenomenal growth in income tax revenue, and so the state was largely able to pick up that responsibility of funding through the general fund. But, of course, now we know, and I think it's been exposed since then, that there was a price to pay for that. And you've seen other areas of state spending decline, higher education being one of the key that during that period saw its share of state support decline as more and more resources were devoted to making up that difference in the K-12 system. So that is one of the illustrations of how voter initiatives impact the state budget and state revenues. I use this when I'm talking in the public about why this is important to us. This is just to make sure that voters understand that 95% of the state budget is devoted to public safety, human services, and education. So when you have a 20% decline in revenue, you're not talking about just making it all up out of low-priority spending areas. That 95% of the budget has already been prioritized to public safety, public human services, and public education, very high-priority program areas. And I like to use this to illustrate, again, to voters just how all dedicated already that state general fund is to these program areas. So the summary of findings at the state level, after all of this, what did we find? And you'll see this in the report with discussion. Number one, the finding is the volatility of the state revenue system. That's clear in spades. Next finding is that the general fund budget has been forced out of balance by voter initiatives. Again, looking at the thinking of the slide since 1990, 50% of state funding now being driven by those voter initiatives, having set the priorities for spending. Also, as the state has become more responsible for funding the K-12 system out of its general fund, that has exposed our K-12 schools to the volatility that is endemic in the rest of the state budget, state revenue system. Property taxes, again, you have that stability there. Not so in the general fund funded by the personal income tax. So schools now are riding on the same roller coaster as every other state-funded program. This is a truism, but it's something that needs to be said, that decisions that the state makes often have long-term implications. This ties in with one of our recommendations, encouraging the legislature to look farther out at the impacts of budget decisions and fiscal decisions, to be aware of the out years and how these play out over time. And then there's just a general statement of support. Really, we worked, I won't say in tandem, but we were aware of the transportation task force the governor had going at the same time, along with the healthcare task force. We heard from them in our task force. We heard reports of what they were recommending. We don't have any specific recommendations on their recommendations. We didn't get that much detail of theirs, but we just this is a tip of the hat to their specific program areas that they will be coming to you, recognizing that those are critical areas of specific concern this session. All right, quickly at the local level, that sort of summarizes where we were with the state. At the local level, property tax really is the name of the game, so we spent some time looking at the impact of property taxes on local government funding. This illustrates the reduction of property tax rates that was wrought by ballot measure 5. Those rates declined to $15 per thousand. You can see that level off there, and that line will continue off the chart just as it appears as well. What I said earlier is illustrated by this chart, and that is that ballot measure 5, while it reduced the property tax rates to $15 per thousand, 5 for schools and 10 for local governments, it did not divorce the property tax system from market value. So property was still being taxed at market value. So what you saw was that during those years that ballot measure 5 was being implemented, a decline in the property tax burden because those rates were being reduced. But once Measure 5 was fully implemented, it caught up then with the appreciation and value of real estate and began to rise again. And so voters saw their property taxes going back up, even under ballot Measure 5. That created the energy for ballot Measure 47. And what ballot Measure 47 did was divorce our property tax system from market value. That red line shows market values and where the property tax system would be today if it were still tied to market value. The black line shows the effect of ballot measure 47, where it retreated to what we call the maximum assessed value, which really was an artificially derived value in 1997, and then limits growth at 3%. From that maximum assessed value. So this is the divorce between our property taxes and market value, assessed value and market value. And this is just another illustration of the growing disparity as market value is projected to increase. You'll see that black line, the stability of the local property tax system now under ballot measure 47, just creeping along there at that 3% rate, and nothing's going to change that. Unlike the income tax system where you saw big swings because of, for instance, recoveries in the economy, you won't have that in the property tax system. That is just going to be what it is for as far as the eye can see under current law. This just shows the effect of that on what we call the effective tax rate, and that is what people actually are paying based on market value. As market value goes up, and the gap between market value and assessed value grows, the effective tax rate on property declines. And you can see this here down to the 0.6 there out in 2027. But that line, too, is expected just to continue declining relative to the growth in market value. Now, if you recall that cardiac arrest slide that showed the volatility of the state income tax system, this really is its local government corollary. The red line shows local government revenue, city and county revenue, based on from all sources, but primarily driven through by the local property tax, which is where the fundamental source of their general funds. The blue line shows expenditures, and obviously there is a problem with this slide, and that is that expenditures already are higher than revenues, and that gap will continue to grow as inflation is expected to outpace the rate of growth in local revenue, driven primarily through the property tax. We believe, working through local governments through the task force, that that gap currently is being accommodated through reductions in spending, cuts in library services and public safety services, things that local governments have control over, and also spending out of reserves. But as those reserves get spent and as cuts get made, it is going to be harder and harder for local governments to accommodate that gap. And so you have here the picture of a structural deficit that in the not very distant future is going to become a critical issue for local governments. I mean, it's already a serious issue, and more so in some than others, but it is going to be pervasive because of this disparity between growth in revenue and spending.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Paul Lang, I'd like to kind of ask the obvious. That blue line is based on current services. current level?
Yes, it is. That's right. We assume current level of services. That's correct. So if services are cut, then that will bring the blue line down to the red line.
And of course, it doesn't deal with services that are not currently being provided but needed for long-term sustainability.
Sure.
The issues that you've already raised where cuts have already happened.
That's correct. And at some point, I assume that you'll cut it about as far as you can cut, and you still have legal responsibilities unless you get to a situation. We'll talk in a second about the timber tax, federal forest funds, where if faced with the prospect of losing that even in the last year, some counties proposing just to close the doors and turn over the keys to the state and say it's yours. At some point, it's going to be hard to accommodate that. This is just another illustration of the gap between revenue and expenditures. Two different inflation scenarios. One is a fairly benign inflation scenario based on those are national numbers, Paul.
Yes.
I keep forgetting how to describe that red line, the inflation assumption there.
Yes, the inflation assumptions here are based on the national projections, and what we did to come up with those current service estimates is use some of the components of the national projections, specifically the deflator for state and local government purchases. So we took, this is the baseline forecast, about 2.5% inflation. The blue line just takes about a 5% inflation rate that was that the index had in both 06 and 07.
Either way, that gap grows. Certainly, under the blue line scenario, it grows more dramatically. What's that? $3 billion by 2018-2019 on a statewide basis. So, our summary of findings at the local level, based on this information, are as follows: that we have a revenue system that's still largely tied to property tax, which is limited by ballot measure 50. We've seen that in the slides. That rising inflation puts the local system under significant stress. I think in the short term that may be mitigated somewhat just because of the economic, the gross economic climate, and there's concern now about even deflation perhaps, but I think over time we can expect that inflation will be the name of the game, and our concern is the longer term impacts of this, and so it remains a significant risk at the local government level. And it's important to remember that permanent property tax rates were locked into the Constitution in 1997 by virtue of ballot measure 50, and those cannot be changed without a constitutional amendment. And so, for instance, you have counties such as Josephine County that had a very, very low rate in 1997 because it was primarily funded through federal forest funds. Well, those federal forest funds have gone away, or I should say they are on the way out. We have 4 more years of federal forest funds. We really anticipate that those will be ended after that. But Josephine County will still be locked in at its permanent tax rate that was reflective of 1997, with no way to change that save a statewide constitutional amendment. And that's just one illustration of how of the impact of that lock-in of those rates under ballot measure 50. It creates measure 50 does create inequities among taxpayers by separating market value from assessed value. We have horizontal inequity where different properties of same market value may be taxed at completely different rates due to the anomalies of ballot measure 50. And we recognized in the task force that there is a link in service provision between state and counties, and this is of concern. Again, if I mention that the state, for instance, mandates the counties certain services such as public health, mental health services, and if at some point counties get to the point that they cannot accommodate, cannot provide those services will fall back to the state to provide because those clients, those needs aren't going to go away. And so this isn't something that the state can divorce from its own fiscal issues. We have to recognize the link between state and local services to our common constituents. So short-term recommendations, then, this is where we, based on the findings, the state findings that I presented to you and the local government findings, we came up with a series of short-term recommendations that are bringing to you for action in this legislative session, and then a series of longer-term options that we think are important to consider that don't necessarily aren't ready for prime time for action, but that we certainly want to put on the table for further consideration by the legislature. Going back to the volatility of the income tax system, that was probably the major issue that we saw at the state level, and how to address that. And, of course, in the past, the tried-and-true recommendation has always been a sales tax. Let's create a new revenue source, and we'll diversify the state revenue system, and that will provide stability and save the day. Voters have had their say time and time again on the sales tax. We tested it. Senator Morse, paid for some polling through Adams Davis Hibbets during the course of our work, just tested the water to see how voters were feeling these days about a sales tax. It's a non-starter in the near term, and I would be embarrassed to you today, although I will say I voted for every sales tax that's been on the ballot since I've been able to vote, but I would be embarrassed to you to come before you today if I were to say that after a year and a half of work with this task force, we found the answer, and it's a sales tax. It's great in theory. We have to recognize where Oregonians are, and I'm really proud of the pragmatism of this task force in recognizing that. We had members very strongly inclined towards sales tax coming into it who, through the course of the evolution of the work that we did here, realized that even that dream is just not attainable in the short term. So what do we do? Our recommendation is that we fix the system we've got, do the best we can with the system that we have. And how do we do that? Well, we've got to start. An income tax system is strong on the upside. Its weakness is on the downside. It's when it falls and you don't have anything underneath it. We started in 2002 to remedy that with the Education Stability Fund. That was during the middle of the 2001-2003 recession. We put out a constitutional amendment to change the Education Trust Fund to an Education Stability Fund, and voters approved that with lottery funding, and we have today now, what is it, about $350 million? What's the numbers in the education? About? 340-something. That's pretty close. It's a good start. And it does have a dedicated source of revenue through the lottery. As a first step into establishing a reserve for the state general fund, it's a good start. But it's not enough. As you saw, education only accounts for 45% roughly of the state general fund. That left 55% of the state budget without a safety net underneath it. The legislature made a good effort last session in creating the statutory rainy day fund that it funded with a one-time appropriation of the corporate kicker and a promise to fund 1% of the ending fund balance in each succeeding biennium. And because of that, you have about a $370 million or so, isn't it, in that rainy day fund. Not enough. One of the tasks of our advisory committee was to look at other states, sort of best practices, what kind of range do we want, should states have for a rainy day fund, a reserve fund, and their recommendations were between 12 and 15%. Again, you're seeing today that it's great to have this reserve, but it's not adequate given the size of our general fund budget and the risks that we're exposed to in economic downturns. So we looked at how we can improve the mousetrap of a reserve fund, and that brought us to the forecast methodology and the kicker. And our recommendation is that, looking at the forecast, and you know how that works. The state economist forecasts a number every 2 years. You, as the legislature, peg the budget to that number. If the revenue is below that number, you reduce spending. If it's more than 2% of the revenue, the kicker applies, and all of the excess revenue is reverted back to taxpayers. That happened just before the 2001-2003 recession, and it happened in 2007 when we reverted $1.2 billion to taxpayers through the income tax kicker. And now, of course, that just on the precipice of the decline, finding ourselves with inadequate to meet current revenue, current program and services commitments. So we're looking at that forecast methodology. As we looked at that in our study, the one thing we determined about the revenue forecast that we know, as a matter of fact, is it's always wrong. And that's not a criticism of the state economist. It's just a reflection of the size of the economy and the vagaries of that forecasting methodology. It's wrong. We know it's wrong. And so our proposal is to calculate every 2 years, how wrong is it? Using historical data up to that point in time, how wrong is it? What's the standard deviation? What can we expect as a margin of error based on all of the years preceding? Right now that number is 5.6%. That's the margin of error based on history. And we would say use that range as part of your forecast so that the budget number is still pegged to the number that the state economist gives you, but recognize that margin of error. And to the extent that revenues come in excess of that point and within that standard deviation, appropriate those to the rainy day fund that the legislature created last session, but in order to instill voter confidence and create real discipline in the use of those funds, elevate that rainy day fund to constitutional status as the Education Stability Fund is, so that it can only be accessed according to the triggers that are in place, economic triggers, and make that a viable rainy day fund. If you had had this methodology in place in the last kicker cycle, $800 million would have been appropriated to the rainy day fund, and you still would have had a $400 million kicker to go out to voters. Under our proposal, any revenues that come in above that margin of error would revert to voters just the way they do the kicker today. And we would set a cap of 10% of the prior fund biennial budget on that rainy day fund, so that once it's filled, it doesn't just keep filling, but then we would revert to current kicker law. We think this honors the spirit of and really intent of the kicker in that it will still mitigate growth in spending by the state, so that we don't spend ourselves into an even higher precipice during those strong economic times, because those excess revenues would not be available for budgeting. They would be set aside in the rainy day fund to serve as a viable cushion during an economic downturn. Two things you need in a rainy day fund: it needs to be big enough to be useful, and it needs to be able to. You have to have a funding mechanism that fills it fast enough so that there is money again by the time you get to the next cycle. So this gets you that,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you. Are you within your recommendations? And I haven't. You may be getting there. In addition to this, keep the current Educational Stability Fund unchanged?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, the Education Stability Fund stays as is. So between the two, our calculation is this gets us to about, I think, a 12%. What's the... it's 15%. Yeah, 15%.
Okay.
I'm sorry. 15.
Follow
10%
up.
In the rainy day fund, 5% in
that's
the...
That's why the 10% cap. I get it. Okay.
Yeah, to deal with that maximum number that he mentioned earlier.
Well, but he said 12 to 15 was your goal, and then you capped at 10, and I'm going, there is something missing.
And we do have to recognize that the Education Stability Fund is not totally liquid. It has in it the Oregon Growth Account, and so that 5% is not always available in cash. We would retain the limit in the rainy day fund of a two-thirds withdrawal in any, well, we would go to an annual cycle, so that there would always be some left in reserve. I think useful in case you have a recession that extends across a biennium, so that it's not all drawn out, but we'll maintain some reserve in there. But in round numbers, we talk about this as a 15% reserve. I do like to say that this is not new. The task force did not create this. It's been around the building, and actually I told the Portland City Club last week that the first recorded use of this particular methodology was in Egypt about 3,000 years ago or so, when Joseph conspired with Pharaoh to set aside these excess grain in the granaries during the during the years of plenty, so that there would be grain available during the lean years. Joseph, of course, is hailed as having been very wise, and some say divinely inspired. I say he had a dream. it just makes sense, and we think this is a good common sense use of excess revenue that we don't anticipate, setting that aside for reserves to be available during times that we know are coming that will be lean. And I would say too that in the polling that.
So the state ought to be following the biblical admonition.
It seems in this case to commend itself. And I would also say.
Representative Riley.
Oh.
Yes. My question is simply, in your recommendations, do some of these have to be constitutional amendments?
Thank you, Representative Riley.
Yes.
Chair Representative Riley, yes. There was a significant discussion in the task force, and those of you who are members will recall, whether we could recommend this statutorily, because the Constitution doesn't specify the methodology by which the forecast is made. And so could we do this? Could we manipulate this statutorily? The answer, I think, is no. We got that answer both from Legislative Counsel and the Department of Justice, who testified to the task force. Even though it's not explicit, their opinion was that this was bound up enough in the constitutional amendment of the kicker. And frankly, as we looked at it, it makes sense, because if we're going to elevate that rainy day fund to constitutional status, we believe, based again on advice of Legislative Counsel and Department of Justice, that you could do that in one constitutional amendment. So the whole package goes up together, both the change in forecast methodology, the reserve fund, and the funding of that, all in one piece. So it makes sense, because our recommendation would have been to elevate that rainy day fund to constitutional status. So I think it's the respectful thing to do. And we hope it instills voters' confidence that there will be real sideboards placed on this.
Thank you.
Moving on, I don't want to take more time here. That's probably the key, I think one of the most important. Another one deals with the initiatives. Now, the first recommendation addresses the volatility of the economic cycle. This one addresses the impact of voter initiatives. And the meat of this one says what we are recommending to the legislature is a statutory change. This does not require constitutional amendment, but this is statutory change to bring into the ballot title explicit notice when a ballot measure will have a significant, to be defined by the legislature, fiscal or revenue impact. As you know, the price tag committee does its work on voter initiatives to determine fiscal and revenue impacts, and that appears in the voter's pamphlet, but it's down below the ballot title, the summary, the yes and no questions, the explanatory. It's down below. And it's there, but it's not particularly evident. This would elevate to the ballot title language that says this measure has a significant fiscal or this measure has a significant revenue impact, so that it just calls to voters' attention that this measure is going to cost money. It doesn't say vote yes or vote no, but it just says be aware that this measure has an impact. And it will highlight to voters that information that is in the voters' pamphlet on the fiscal costs of these, so that voters can be better informed about the revenue and fiscal impacts of voter initiatives. Also, I should mention that there was another recommendation that came in at the last meeting. Is that on this slide? To improve legislative involvement in the initiative process, and it did come in at the very last meeting. It's not particularly specific, but we're recommending either that the legislature hold hearings on measures that have been qualified for the ballot. I think Senator Morse was strong in his recommendation of looking at a change to the indirect initiative process. process, that would require a constitutional amendment, but the intent there being, again, something to better inform voters, provide a better source of information to voters about ballot measures that they're being asked to vote on. Then another recommendation, developing a long-term budgeting process that includes long-term capital spending plan, mostly being aware that we don't fund just programs and services on a biennium-to-biennium basis. Capital spending, as you are hearing, I know in this session already, is a big issue that we just don't address in our budget forecast and methodology. It's out there and needs to be taken into account. On the local side, we are recommending that in the short term, again, we saw a pretty critical situation for local government. We don't have any immediate recommendations to reform the property tax system or something like that. I think also voters are not ready to go there, and it's going to take some time to develop some viable proposals at the local level. But in the meantime, our recommendation to the legislature is basically the Hippocratic Oath, and that is to do no more harm in imposing additional mandates and spending requirements on local governments, recognizing their limited resources already and their stretched missions. So that's a recommendation there. And also that touches on the revenue side, also recommended the legislature not enact any new property tax expenditures that reduces their revenue. And the last of the short-term recommendations being established with an ongoing process to engage the public. Clearly, when we talk about more revenue reform, you've got to have an informed and educated and engaged public. And we think that these recommendations are doable in the short term. Other reforms, if we're going to go there in the future, are clearly going to have to be based on a much more engaged process of public outreach and education. We think that the task force was a good start, but we're recommending the legislature work possibly with private foundations, other sources, maybe on the chalkboard project model, something like that, to continue this process of educating the public on our budget and revenue systems, so that they're informed about how we pay for services that that they require. So those are our short-term recommendations. Long-term, I'll just go briefly over these. Sort of starting off at the last of the short-term recommendations, use the results of public engagement process to guide development. Don't start the public engagement process with a predetermined outcome, but let that be an iterative process that in 2 years, 4 years, whatever the case might be, can guide any more reforms that the legislature may deem to be recommended. Looking at the local level, it's clear that we're going to have to get to that, if not in this session, soon, increase the adequacy and flexibility of their system. We have in our report some possible ways that the Measure 50 could be changed, the property tax system, to strengthen local governments. That raises issues of voter support, and it's not a very encouraging outlook right now for voter support for property tax changes. Another recommendation is diversification away from the property tax. Are there, if we're going to have trouble reforming the property tax system, are there other sources of revenue? It's not recommended by the task force, but one that comes to my mind, and I'm speaking for myself, something real estate transfer tax, some sort of other revenue system that can support local governments outside of the property tax system, and then also being aware that we're going to have to replace declining federal timber revenue that's going to exacerbate this decline, this structural deficit that we see in local revenue among the counties that depend on those sources. And then continue to analyze more dramatic restructure proposals. This is basically sales tax and other types of consumption taxes. We've included in the report analyses of those, of several scenarios. mostly just to provide information for future discussion for folks that may want to look at that. We've analyzed them in terms of economic impacts to the state, jobs, revenue distribution among various income tax among income groups. That's there. But again, as I said earlier, we're not making a recommendation on the adoption of a sales tax either now or even, you know, in the near-term future. So, Mr. Chair, I think that summarizes the report and recommendations to you. I hope it's been useful. I know this was an excellent exercise by the task force to get to this point. And I am gratified by the governor's support of the recommendations coming out of the task force. I understand that there are bills in draft, even as we speak, perhaps to implement these recommendations, some that would come before your committee, some others. But I commend them to you, and to the extent that I can be of any service to your committee during the session to help with those efforts, I will be happy to make myself available. You wanted to wrap this up in an hour. I've got a few minutes for questions, if there are any of the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think this is a great time for questions. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You didn't talk at all about corporate taxes and the corporate share of the tax burden. Did the committee, the commission, look at that at all? And
we did have, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we did have conversation about that, and fairly regular conversation. I think, if I could express it, where we came down the task force was of interest looking more at the gross structure of the state revenue system, recognizing that the policy committees during the session are going to be looking at a host of individual tax proposals within that structure. Corporate taxes, beer and wine tax, cigarette tax. I mean, they're all capital gains tax. All those things are discrete revenue proposals. And frankly, we decided not to get into the specifics of those various policy areas, but to focus on more the structure of the system. And because all of these other pieces can fit within that structure. We're mostly concerned, at least in the recommendations we've made here in the short term, of stabilizing that system. However, whatever inputs you want to put into that system, what we've recommended will maintain stability. And that we thought was probably most important, and not to get divided among the task force, among different opinions on various specific tax proposals. And I will say we had success in that the recommendations coming to you today do reflect a consensus of the task force, for which I'm very pleased. I think had we gotten into specifics about corporate minimum, capital gains, beer and wine, cigarette taxes, I think you probably would have seen that consensus much more harder to achieve. And so... Again, I think the structure here is itself important. And in terms of adequacy as well, this structure will maintain stability of whatever level of funding the legislature wants to create.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? May I just add, I believe that this interaction is a key point, and one of the huge strengths of this report. And the restructure task force's work. I was one of those who asked the same question, Representative Riley, that you asked, and pushed a bit to try to get other things in the report. But on reflection, I believe that what we actually did was very wise, because it was a consensus of the commission, and including all the legislators who attended the last few meetings. I won't say that everyone was there at all of the meetings, but the people who were there all agreed when the time came to object that these were the things we would recommend. And I think they're pretty significant.
Absolutely.
In terms of if the legislature can enact the recommendations that are contained in this report, we will have moved a giant step forward on the stability of our revenue system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Just a comment to thank our chair and and the work that he does, and to comment, Lane, that as you're talking about how revenue forecasts are wrong all the time, I'm looking right beyond you to Tom Petowsky.
Yeah,
so if you saw me smile, it was just a matter of my visual, Lane. But I want to thank you and the members of your task force for this incredible effort. You've done it. You've brought us solid things that we can work on, and you've done it through a process that works. And there are, I know, four members of this committee who were on your task force, but there were a lot of other citizens who did a lot of work, and we appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, thank you very much. And to Tom, behind me and to my left, I hope he was also here to say that the errors in the revenue forecast are no reflection on the state economy.
I understand. But my visual was perfect.
In fact, trying to predict what the temperature is going to be today, two years hence.
That's absolutely correct. Others? I want to add my thanks to you and to the task force, the governor's office, Tim, who's sitting behind you, attended all of those meetings, even though he wasn't a member, representing the governor. And I personally appreciate this. And I know that you personally have been working on these issues in a general sense for a long time. I'm hopeful that we will actually be able to enact some of these reforms and get the state's revenue system on a more even keel. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was a pleasure. I enjoy working with you, as always, and the other legislative members of the task force as well. Great exercise. I really think it was. As you know, we entered this with some trepidation because the history of tax reform in this state is not stellar. I think that by trying to keep our sights focused on the achievable and not get caught up in reaching for the stars, I think we have brought you something that is doable, but by the same token is also would be very significant in improving our revenue system for the good of every generation to come.
Thank you. And I can tell you that I believe this committee will take these recommendations very seriously. As you went over the recommendations again, I realized that there are at least two other committees who will probably welcome your report because of the issues, the recommendations that are within their jurisdictions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Others? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And our second item on the agenda today for information meeting is a methodology review. And I think we're going to hear from the officer who now occupies the position that is always wrong, Mr. Petowsky. Thank you for coming. And I appreciate your smile at the ribbing that is not directed at you, it's directed at the job that we have assigned you to do.
Yes, well, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petowsky, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis and Department of Administrative Services. And Lane, I love you too. I only have 20 minutes. I have probably more slides than what I have my time allotted to. I wanted to provide that for you for information. So I'm going to go rather quickly through this so that we also have some time for some questions. What I first want to do is this first slide. We usually show this when we start our quarterly revenue release to the committees. And just going through here, just notice it's a fairly detailed process, and this is done every single quarter. We meet with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. These are 12 individuals that are economists, business analysts, people that really have a sense of what's going on in the state. We have specialists in the energy field, retail field, and so forth. And I will say, the governor's advisors are made up of single-minded individuals. There are people on the council that do not probably share views of the governor, but they are good economists, and they do know about forecasting, and thus we have them on the committee. Well, they take a look at Global Insight, which is a national forecasting firm that provides us with what the national economy is looking like. That really does affect us and how the Oregon economy operates. So we meet with them first, then we work through our economic model, and then we provide a preliminary forecast. That will occur, by the way, for the March forecast, will be next week, Friday, on January 30th. We'll have an all-day meeting with our advisors. The one advisory group down here on the side is the DAS Advisory Committee. That's made up of government agencies mainly that either we get information from or they use our information. And we find that's a very nice mix and review that we have in the morning hours. And then in the afternoon, we meet once again with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors to review what is the economic outlook for the state. We take into account all their comments. We come up with a final economic forecast. And the economic forecast then, that view drives what's going to happen with the revenue forecast. We've broken out here the personal income and the corporate income tax models. We provide a outlook for that. Then we meet with a council of revenue forecast advisors. This is a group of CPAs, financial analysts, especially generally with higher income groups, because the higher income groups really do have an ability to push around our personal income taxes, especially. We meet with them, discuss, see what happens. By the way, also the Department of Revenue is part of that committee, and also Paul's office, Legislative Revenue Office, is part of that committee. We then bring all that together. We see if there's any legislative or policy changes that may affect the forecast. And then finally, we come up with the final revenue estimate that's provided each quarter. Timing of these quarterly forecasts, there's a March, June, September, and December. But during odd years when the legislature is in session, we have a mid-May forecast that's generally sometimes called the May 15th forecast. Generally, these releases dates are the last week of the previous month. As an example, if you do the September one, it's generally released in the last week of August. We have the March 2009 forecast. That release date is going to be on February 20th. The close of session forecast. This is a forecast that will be coming up this year. It is based on the mid-May forecast, and this is why a lot of attention generally is associated with that mid-May forecast. And then it also includes any legislative changes that have occurred in the remainder of the session. We put all that information together, and that's usually released then with the September forecast. It's interesting. It's technically, it's not the September forecast, but it is technically a separate forecast called the close of session. The importance of that close of session forecast is that that's the one that's used for budgeting purposes for the upcoming biennium, and that's also the base for the kicker calculations. So I'm going to quickly just talk a little bit about the general fund revenues that we look at. Personal income taxes, incorporation, and a little bit about lottery, because that also is part of our billowack that we look at. Our guiding principles for our forecast. It's a current law general fund forecast. It's updated, as I said, quarterly. We see it's very much as an unbiased, most likely forecast, given prevailing economic conditions and assumptions. You know, we know the kicker is out there, but we consciously don't view that the kicker is there. And what I mean by that is we don't try to say, well, this is what we think is the most likely outcome, but heck, if the kicker happened, why don't we just raise it up a little bit? Or if we feel that possibly we're not sure about risks, let's lower it a lot just to be on the safe side. We don't think that's our job. We are not setting budget. We are setting the recommendation and for you to plan for the budget. So our best use, I think, is to have a completely unbiased forecast. We always continue to refine these models, develop new data sources. We have a wonderful working relationship with the Revenue Department, who's been very helpful to us. And we also explore expert input whenever we can for improving our accuracy. So also for every forecast, we provide users with a measure of the potential for actual revenues to deviate. So in our revenue publication, we have in there each time we say that revenues could deviate by a certain percentage. And generally that's based on a deviation type measure. This gives you just a quick look at the 2007-09 forecast. This is from the December forecast. What I just want to point out here, you look at personal income taxes. They're 86.3% of the general fund revenues. Corporate income is 6.7%. Taken together, you have 93% of the general fund is taken with those two items. Thus, accordingly, we spend most of our time on these two areas. Because if we can get these fairly close, we're pretty much, you know, in the game and doing well. Types of forecasting methods, we're using statistical methods, generally regression-type methods, for our PIT, our CORP, for the cigarette and tobacco taxes. We don't have the resources to do all of these different areas, so we do rely on certain agencies to provide their own forecast for things like liquor, insurance, security fees, and they have statistical models to do that. And then also we use some simple trend or historical averages. For example, in inheritance, we're sometimes characterized as the office of the Grim Reaper, but we don't have that kind of forecasting capability, and so something like inheritance taxes are rather difficult to get at. It's best just to sort of look at trend. This is just kind of schematic, and it's kind of how we look at things. You know, there are the economic conditions out there. We know that affects incomes, incomes of households, incomes of businesses. Thus, what is going to be their tax liability based on that, and then finally, what are the tax collections that flow in to the state? These are the components, the main ones from the personal income tax. Wages, as you see, makes up one of the largest components, and so we try to get that, and luckily that is somewhat stable over time, although it can be have more variability, especially when we get in tough economic times like today. But you come down to capital gains, which at the moment is 9% based on the 2006, which oddly enough is the latest true data that we have on these items. And that's one of our concerns, because that can be a very volatile item. We saw what happened to capital gains falling by 50% in one fiscal year back in 2001. So we're very careful to want to look at this and look at what were the conditions that caused that to happen in the past. So we'll take a help of history here, and now what we're seeing today, this is one of our big worries that we may have that change on us. Timing of collections. Withholding comes in pretty steady through the year. We also have estimated payments. And as we reported on January 16th, which, by the way, the January 16th is very unusual for us to actually step forward and give some sort of formal update on what's happening. Given the economic condition, how fast they're changing, we felt a very need to do that. Usually the quarterly forecasts are sufficient time-wise, but this is a very unusual period. Estimated payments are the lighter blue line. And the fourth quarter is an important one that comes in. And just most recently, we've seen these fall quite by a large amount. And so that has us worried because this is, for example, a typical tax year. And then you have to reconcile that tax year in the next calendar year. And so the quarter six down here, that's April, is right in there. And so April 15th, people have their final payments, and they also get lots of refunds. Our worry right now as we're going forward, because we don't know what will happen until we actually see the numbers, but given what's happened with estimated payments, given the condition of the economy, we're concerned that that bar that says final is going to be a lot shorter, and that bar that says that goes down for refunds is going to be a lot longer. Corporate methodology, real briefly here, we use the latest data that we have, the actual data that combines the corporate tax to the particular tax year. 2007 is the next year available, and that will probably be available at the start of 2009. I throw an equation here just to make sure you feel good about that we're an economist and we use equations. It's just the idea of we're trying to get a sense of what is the corporate tax income really to Oregon. And so we sort of use the national forecast and kind of apportion what my Oregon share would be. And then, as Paul will say later, then there are steps that we have to make in terms of like the single sales factor apportionment of how much of that total then Oregon corporate income is apportioned to Oregon itself. Multi-tax state taxpayers are the biggest bulk of what happens in here. And liabilities translated to collections, very similar to historical patterns that we do for personal income. But we will say that this is probably, along with capital gains, the most volatile tax source we have. It can just move all over the place. Not only because of economic conditions, but if you have a major business that either is done very well or very poorly management-wise, can have an impact regardless of the economic conditions. Risks of this forecast, these are just a couple, and not I would say, the complete list. We said capital gains is very high, corporate profits, they've been up there for quite a bit now, and we have them down in the forecast, but given the economic conditions, they could fall by even more. And then, of course, the economic recession. We know we're in one. Our biggest concern right now is the depth going to be greater than we think, and that duration. Because the duration, too, could then have more spillover effects to the next biennium. And then also the volatility, as Lane was discussing, of the especially the personal income tax and the corporate income tax. That is an area of risk. We were just looking at the volatility of the actual state tax incomes and the general fund revenues. And it appears that Paul was extremely well-versed in this, because from the point of the early sort of 80s to about the end of the 90s, the volatility was a little over 4.5%. And then from the 2000 to about now, the volatility is over 10%. And Paul left this office right at the end of the 90s. So, interesting enough, the volatility has gotten much worse in the most recent time.
Well, we already know that your biggest challenge is predicting the turns, the changes in trend, or even if they're short term. And the period of time that you described had very few of those. You've had the pleasure of serving during a time when we've had at least three turns already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding me. Paul made no mention of this when he suggested me for this job.
He didn't warn you that was going to happen.
No, he did not.
I told him the business cycle is dead.
And I just want to briefly talk about lottery, because that also is an area that we forecast. We spend most of our time on video lottery aspects. That includes the what used to be the traditional video poker, and now includes the line games, the sort of the slot machine stuff. And that is the major part of the lottery. We sort of project this along with consumption growth. That seems to have been doing very well in terms of a predictive variable. And like this recession, and given that consumption has dropped quite dramatically, it is showing up in lottery, likewise, as a drop. Seasonal swings, we have to keep that into account. Definitely, we're coming into the period of generally the highest lottery sales of the year, given the weather. And then week-to-week variations and also paydays make a difference, and we take those into account.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Berger.
And as I understand, you even pointed out at one point a kicker check made a difference. There was a jump when the kicker went out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, there appeared to be a statistical correlation there.
Well put.
Cause
Tom.
And effect, we will leave to other analysts.
Thank you.
Then there's the traditional games. We also forecast these and have different models for each of these. Mostly it is by trend. And given that we cannot forecast a jackpot levels, this makes it rather difficult, because definitely as jackpot levels go up, the sales go up accordingly. When the jackpot is hit, the sales drop. And so you don't know when you're going to have one and to what size will be the jackpot roll-up. Risks to this forecast, definitely the recession impact on consumption is a relatively new risk that we've seen to the lottery forecast. Aspects of tribal casinos, how they may expand or new ones that may come up. And then also the impact from the smoking restrictions. We just have basically about 2 weeks of data in on that, and we'll have to see. We've already dropped the forecast by about 6% for this. It's tough to tell right now to what extent it should be maybe a little bit lower than that, whether it's the smoking ban, we didn't have a large enough drop, or is it the recessionary situation that's really causing this? It's causing it to be down farther.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question on that. Has your methodology with respect to the impact of the smoking restrictions been a function of what's happened in other states who've gone through similar processes? And I know it's only 2 weeks, but does that look like that methodology is proving to be reliable so far?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, I think so. We looked at a lot of other states. We actually looked at some other countries and what they were experiencing. And what we're finding is that, at least right now, the drop that we're seeing with the smoking ban being implemented is not as large as what occurred in some other states. And we figured that would probably be the case because there was quite a bit of a lead time coming up to this, where a lot of other states was almost, you know, here it is, here's the smoking ban, and very little time to adjust to it. So we think that there were probably establishments that were already going somewhat non-smoking even before the ban happened, so we started to see that effect already. But as I've just said, it could be maybe it was a little bit more than what we thought, but not to something like the 20% range that we've seen in some other states.
Thank you.
And with that, this is our website where we have all our information available that you can see the wild ride that we're on. And I can take some questions.
Great. Yes, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Tom. I'm looking at slide six, which is your guiding principles, and specifically the third bullet point, which says continue to refine models, develop new data sources. I'm just curious, given the size and scope of this recession we're in, I realize it's a unique, I mean, you've said yourself it's unique, but given the size and the scope, what we have learned that will affect future modeling. And I don't mean so much this current period. We know it's a little steeper than we thought and all of that. But what from this, if anything, have we learned that will change our modeling going forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brune, I think one is that we've got to recognize that the business cycle is not dead. We will continue to have those. In our modeling, we have to recognize how fast the situation can change. Now, that's a tough one to actually put into modeling when you have changes that, you know, like for the end of 2008, basically we fell off a cliff, you know, in just a couple of months. And trying to prepare for something like the financial meltdown, which we never recognized the full force of until we were actually in it. So in terms of the modeling, it's kind of tough to say how exactly we would change based on this. What I think it does to us is we've got to look more closely at the current information and how can we incorporate as soon as something happens into the model. We do have, for example, our Oregon Leading Economic Indicator model. And that's trying to give us some aspect of turning points, because that should be a prospective look 3 to 6 months down the road. So what we're doing is taking a look at that and saying, well, what other information, leading indicators, can we put in there that maybe we're missing? Is there something dealing with the financial markets that would be more indicative of what we have right now, which is an interest rate spread? I think possibly more there's these credit interest spreads that might be more indicative of trouble that may be happening.
Okay, just one quick follow-up.
Yes, sure. Please.
Had our modeling been reducing the impact of business cycles? Your first point was we have to make sure we don't do that. But had our modeling, whether at the state level or the things that you contract with nationally, in your estimation, have we been reducing the estimation or impacts of business cycles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broun, I would say somewhat yes. Now, in terms of how you word that, it's the predictability that there's a business cycle and to what size and timing of it. And so that part, I think, has improved a little bit. Now, if we look at this one, you'd have to question whether there's actually been an improvement or not. But the call was always there for the downturn. I've always likened it that, you know, the modeling national firms that do this stuff, you know, they don't do a bad job on the direction of the economy. Is it slowing down? And then they also try to forecast when that will happen. And they have a really difficult time putting those two pieces of information together correctly. For example, our office, we were laughed at, I would say, for a while, because we were, even in 2006, saying that the housing market had to really slow down. And it just kept going along and going along. And it doesn't help too much to, you know, if you stick with the forecast long enough, it's bound to come true. So what we have to work on, and the toughest part, and Mr. Chair alluded to this, are turning points and when they happen.
Thank you. Just a quick comment on that last point, that the housing bubble has been building for at least two decades, and the fact that you predicted it only 2 years early is pretty good. The turn on the bubble, on the housing bubble. I've been aware, and of course, as you know, I'm not an economist, but I've been aware that these turns seem to be associated with the breaking of bubbles. The dot-com bubble seemed to be associated with the recession that we dealt with earlier in this decade, and now the much longer-term housing bubble seems to be connected with this one. Is that a typical relationship between downturns and the trends in the economy?
Mr. Chair, it was, especially, as you said, for the past two recessions. For example, in the 91 recession, here was a case of just kind of a breakdown, especially in the Asian Pacific Rim area. And there was sort of a financial problem, and it was really just relationships that were breaking down. The transparency and so on wasn't there, some bad lending going on, and that sort of precipitated, not really necessarily a bubble. But generally, you know, I'd say somewhat that is a good characterization. You have some sort of buildup of activity that's not sustainable for one reason or the other.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, the question, I guess, is Oregon, or was Oregon, alone in its forecasting difficulties, or was this pretty much across the nation? Because my guess is it was across the nation, but that's what I'm asking. In other words, do other economic forecasters face the same challenge as you do, and or was somebody out ahead of all of us and actually saw it coming?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think all you have to do, an indication that the forecasts were off in other states is that they have a budget problem now.
Yeah,
if they wasn't a budget problem, their forecasting would have been accurate because they had to then budget to the forecast. So there's only now a handful of states that don't have a budget problem, but those are ones that have had situations where it was a West Virginia, for example, the natural resource, coal was doing okay, and they were not much variability. New Mexico, for example, because of the natural gas for a while. Alaska was doing all right because of the oil situation. Wyoming. And so they, you know, were okay because even though the recession hit, and they probably didn't forecast it to be as bad as it was, they were somewhat insulated because of the type of economies they had. But otherwise, this is across the board. And I would just, you know, California has a much bigger office than I have, and their budget situation is proportionally much worse than ours.
Yes, Paul.
Opportunities I had in the past was before I came to Oregon, I forecasted a state with sales tax revenue. And I think that is an advantage. It is one of the complicating factors for Tom's job. Not that I'm advocating a sales tax, Mr. Chair, but one of the things I had was I had monthly data, sales by industry sector, by county. And I got that within a couple of weeks of the month being over. And that was a good insight into what spending patterns are and gave me, because it was came up to date relatively quickly, it gave me some indicators of what was going on. Now, Tom has withholding data that he's described on a monthly basis, but still in terms of the sales and particularly the kind of change we've seen now, that would be good information to have would allow you a little bit more insight than what we have just based on income tax data.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I probably wouldn't be wise to advocate maybe a half a cent sales tax just for that purpose.
This would be the, on the record.
The economic measurement sales tax.
Yeah, the economic measurement.
Yes. Thank you. That's an interesting
proposition.
For data
purposes only. Oh, thank you again, Mr. Chair. Tom, I'm not asking you to throw global insights under the bus, but I guess I'm asking you, I know we use them predominantly, were there other large major firms that compete with Global Insights that did a slightly better or significantly better job, or were they just across the board all wrong, dismally wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brune, we get a publication that's called the Blue Chips Forecast, and it has approximately 50 national forecasting firms that look over the economy. And I would say not a single one really predicted that it was going to be this bad.
Thank you. Others? We appreciate very much the update. I think I appreciate a little better too the range of estimates that you gave us the other day, because you didn't go through all of this process in working on that one, but you attempted to give us some sense of the scope of the issues we're dealing with. And I assume that you would say that we shouldn't; those numbers are not specific, and we shouldn't think of them as specific.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct. But you know, it is giving you that heads up, because, well, frankly, time is running out for this biennium.
Yes, it is, and I believe that we needed the warning and appreciate it, because we're going to be faced with the problem of getting the budget balanced by the end of June, and if we have any chance of accomplishing that, we have to be at work on it now. Thank you. Anything
thank
else?
You,
thank you, sir. We appreciate your appearance today. Paul?
Mr. Chair, we have a couple more things. This is our methodology review with you and some of the tools, and of course the distinction that Tom made in the role that his office plays is that they are forecasting current law revenue, so their assumption about state law is that it doesn't change, even if it's a sunset, even if it's something that everybody assumes that's going to be extended. Their forecast will be tied directly to current law and cannot assume a sunset. I will say there is a little bit of a gray area where we do work together, and that is on federal law, because you have to make some assumptions about federal law. We've come up with this in terms of the alternative minimum tax, for example. It's extended each year. And we've assumed that that's a reasonable assumption as kind of an external factor. And Chris works directly with Tom's shop and trying to get those federal estimates. But when we get to the close of session, when we do revenue impact analysis, one of the things that our state has done that's a little different than a lot of states is that becomes really solely a legislative responsibility in trying to estimate revenue. We have the statutory authority you've given us to prepare a revenue impact on each bill, and each one of those comes to my desk, and what I do in that process, which is really separate and distinct from our committee process, is to assign whether that bill has a no revenue impact, and a number of them you can make that determination pretty quickly, or whether it's a possible, and then I'll assign it to one of our economists. But I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the impact statement, and I have just a dummy copy of one in your packet. It's just a one page. Tell you kind of some of the underlying assumptions we make in deriving those revenue impacts. And then also talk about a formal addition we've made to the statement that I mentioned earlier about tax expenditures. The revenue impact statement will come with any bill. It doesn't necessarily have to come through the Revenue Committee, but most of them will, and we encourage that in most cases. The revenue impact, and I think also did mention that one of the differences in process this session is that we have been directed by leadership to, even in those bills that have a subsequent referral to revenue, is to prepare a revenue impact statement. So if you have a bill come over from, let's say, Veterans Committee, for example, and you have some already that are with a subsequent to Revenue Committee, they will have an impact statement with it. We will, in some cases, we may look at that more closely when it gets over here and may make some modifications, but it will have at least a preliminary impact statement with it. Just a couple of things that we do in terms of a revenue impact, some of the guidelines we follow. One of the things that assumptions that we have to make, we think, just just because we don't have the capacity to determine how individual decisions are made, we assume that when you enact a tax credit, for example, we don't assume any behavioral change from that in determining our revenue impact. So if you say, well, we're going to extend the enterprise zone program, for example, and we know that, or we assume that no business would locate here if we didn't have an enterprise zone, well, then you wouldn't get any property tax revenue, right? So how could that have a revenue impact? We're often given that question. And my answer is that, you know, it may or may not work. I tend to think of these development incentives as a probability. You know, you may move across that spectrum. It's never 100%. You may go from a 20% probability to 40%. And there's some statistical things you could do, but I think in reality, we don't have the capacity to judge whether this individual company made this decision because of this particular incentive. So what we try to do is give you a revenue impact based on the current law trend forecast. The trend forecast that Tom develops has built-in growth. I mean, he's assuming that there's growth involved in the economy, that there's capital investment taking place, that jobs are being created, and I'll talk about the most recent forecast, but out there over the long term, there are jobs being created. So we apply these assumptions of our revenue impact off that base. So we're not going to try to decipher whether this incentive would work and this other one wouldn't. We just simply don't have the information. It's not in the literature. So you'll see that when you see our impact statements, those kinds of incentives will tend to have a negative effect because it's a negative from what current law is. And in effect, we're making the conservative assumption that it doesn't have an effect for purposes of that revenue impact. Now, where we will make a change on a revenue impact is when it's something that we think is large enough to potentially affect the revenue system. And in that case, what we'll do is we will run our analysis through our Oregon Tax Incidence Model. And that's what we did for the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. When we looked at changes of going to a sales tax or a gross receipts tax or changing the corporate income tax to a value-added tax, those kinds of things. And some of that analysis is in your report. And actually, there's some detailed stuff in the appendices. We need Vice Chair Bailey here would be the one that would be most interested, I think, in looking at some of the details on that. But that would give you a feel for what we can do. Most states don't do that, and we think that's a valuable tool, and Chris will go through that with you for looking at major proposals because it does build in what's called a dynamic revenue impact analysis. In most cases, our impact analysis is static. We assume that behavior is not affected by the tax change, and we just say everything else is the same. Here's the revenue impact based on analysis of tax returns or analysis from the assessors or other kind of analysis we have from excise taxes, for example. The one area where we do think we know enough specifically, besides the big changes, for a dynamic analysis is on cigarette taxes. And we will build in a behavioral effect because that's very well documented. The effect of increasing prices of cigarettes reduces consumption. And we've done it enough times in this state, and a lot of states have done it, so we can, those estimates that you'll get and that Day will be working on, for example, for the governor's proposal, will incorporate some behavioral effects from higher prices due to a tax increase. So that will be embedded in there. We have a detailed model that can do that. So that gives you kind of a sense of kind of the analysis we have, and we're certainly realize that you know, some of the impacts we do have very detailed information like income tax estimates. Others are much less so, and we'll try to inform you and give you as best sense we can what our level of confidence is. And it does vary with those proposals. If it's something that we have no tax base for right now, if it's a totally new tax, we don't have good information, we'll tell you that this is our best guess, this is our unbiased estimate, but we think there's a lot of range for error here. You can see in terms of the table, the general fund piece is the most important, of course, in terms of that close of session estimate that Tom talked about. What we do is when you've concluded your work for the session, we'll sum these up that have revenue impacts on the general fund, and then these are the numbers we'll talk with Tom about that he will build into the close of session estimate for the kicker numbers. We will also look at other fund impacts, and we do look at local revenue impacts too. So if you change property taxes, for example, we'll prepare an impact statement for local revenue. The last thing I wanted to say before Chris talks about OTIM is the last piece we have there, the create, extend, or expand tax expenditure, is a new item. Last session, we had a lot of discussion with the chair, with both chairs of revenue committees about how can we build this in. We did include some in our measure summary statements about the bill. We included some expected outcomes. But we thought this might be a more formal way to do it because what it does is the impact statement is something that's unique to the revenue office. I mean, we're the only ones who do it by statute. The measure summaries are done by all the committees to describe a bill. So we thought this might be a good forum to do this. So what we're going to include in these statements is, does it have create, extend, or expand a tax expenditure? We'll check that box, and many times it'll be no, and then we'll just end it there. But we want to include a public policy purpose in there, and June has actually put that in there, so that's how it starts. And so we will try to interpret what you have as a policy purpose. We'll need some feedback from you on that, obviously, and if this is consistent what the committee's thinking is and what that this is the intention of doing this. And then below that, we will have the expected outcomes, and that's where I think we'll have to work, particularly if agencies come in and are going to manage a credit like the business energy tax credit, for example. We would expect some outcomes to be described, and so that the committee can come back in 2 or 4 years and try to determine whether this has actually accomplished what was anticipated. So we're hoping this gives you a structure to work with and helps the Department of Revenue in doing the tax expenditure report every 2 years.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Appreciate it. And then we're going to talk about OTIM?
We're going to talk about OTIM briefly, and we know that everybody's been anxiously waiting to hear about OTIM.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue Office. And the reference sheet, you should have a sheet in your stack there, Oregon Tax Incidence Model, with the funky little diagram at the bottom. So what I was just going to briefly talk about the background of OTIM and kind of what it does and how we use it. It was created at directed by the 1999 legislature, and that was to get at the notion of what kind of feedback effects do various tax proposals have. It's trying to get at that question, as well as getting at the question of final incidence of taxation in terms of businesses passing on the taxation that they are legally required to remit, the tax that they incurred, does that get passed, to what extent did that get passed on to owners of capital, customers, or employees? It was developed primarily by Ed Waters, who was with LRO at the time, and then Dave Holland from Washington State University and Bruce Weber from OSU. And at the time, it focused on 1997 data. And then the office, since that time, Ed Waters has gone in. He's a private economic consultant now. And in 2006, we contracted out with him to update it for more recent information. and it's currently based largely on 2001 data. That was the most recently available information that was available at the time. It is largely based on, or partially based on, California's dynamic revenue analysis model. They had undertaken a significant amount of work to put together their tax incidence model, and so this is built upon that, benefiting from that work. The key players in the model, the sectors that you have, firms, households, government, and the rest of the world, it's a computable general equilibrium model of the Oregon economy, and so the rest of the world is just everybody outside of Oregon. So it's the other U.S. states as well as international. It's all treated as one sector. Now, the computable general equilibrium model, it's one way to describe it is a comparative statics model. It assumes that it's based on the 2001 Oregon economy and assumes that that's in equilibrium. And then we apply some policy change to it, and then all of the equations solve through to equilibrium again. And so it's kind of comparing two points in time. And why that is one important aspect of that is that it's not a cyclical model. It doesn't measure the ups and downs in an economy over time. So it doesn't take into boom periods and recession periods. It doesn't incorporate the business cycle, if you will. It just compares two kind of alternate realities, one with the current law structure, the current economy, and then if some significant policy change had been in place, what would the prices and the income and expenditures have been under that scenario. And there is no time aspect to it, but we assume that time period, it takes 5 years from a policy change to when the new equilibrium is reached. And we assume that phases in over in a uniform fashion. Within OTIM, there are 110 sectors. We have 29 industrial sectors, manufacturing, services, and some sub-manufacturing, some wood products, financial services. There are two factors of production, labor and capital. There are 8 household sectors, from low-income to high-income folks, and that's how we use that to get at the final incidence in terms of the impact on the household sectors. There are 58 state and local government sectors. It is extensively developed for the government sector, given the purpose of the model is to analyze tax policy changes. So within those 58 sectors, there are 30 state taxes in there, the big ones, personal income tax, corporate income tax, property tax, all the way down to hunting and license fees. And there are 3 spending sectors at the state level, education, non-education, and investment. And at the local level, there are 22 tax categories, with the largest being property tax, and then an analogous 3 spending sectors, education, non-education, and investment. So to date, there is extensive development on the revenue side, and one of the areas that we're talking about for potential improvement in future versions is developing the spending side more, to develop more sectors within that rather than just kind of a non-education-education split. There are also 11 federal sectors, 10 tax sectors, payroll taxes, income taxes, corporate taxes, and then a government spending category. And then there's 1 investment and 1 trade, kind of the import and export. The key behavioral relationships, it focuses on consumer demand and producer behavior. Some key assumptions are supply equals demand. That's getting at the current equilibrium and resolving to the new equilibrium. When the result of the policy changes is that prices adjust. That's kind of the key piece in the model. You change the income tax, you change the corporate tax, or you introduce a sales tax, and then all of the prices adjust, so we can see how households and firms respond to those new prices, and then that's ultimately the new equilibrium. So just to touch briefly on that graph there, on that circular flow diagram, this has all of the sectors, the households, the firms, all of the actors in the economy. And you have 2 sets of lines. You have a solid line and a dashed line. The dashed lines are kind of the dollar flow, the monetary flow through the economy. And the solid line are the real aspects of the economy, if you will. So, for example, looking at the household block there on the left side, we can see that it it purchases goods and services, so the money goes through goods and services and then to firms, and that's how the dashed line flows. And the firms, on the other hand, they produce the goods and services, so that you have a solid line going from the firms to the goods and services, and then the households buy those goods and services. And so you can see how the flow of that diagram of the model works. And that's I kind of think of this in terms of a lot of the discussions now about the financial markets and the freezing up of capital. It's kind of mucking up the works in this flow and the diagram, kind of relating that discussion to this diagram here. It's mucking that up. So the key things about it are providing a dynamic impact. So to start, the model is fed a static impact, and that's what Paul was talking about before. So if it's a personal income tax change, we have our other models to make the static estimate. We feed that into the model, and then we see how the prices adjust to that new to the new tax. And in the end, we have the behavior and then the dynamic feedback. So that accounts for any change in the taxation. Generally speaking, when we have institute a relatively simple policy, a tax increase or tax decrease, the dynamic impact tends to mitigate that. So if it's a tax increase, the static impact may be a level up to here, but the dynamic will reduce that down to some level. We haven't found a policy yet that it offsets where a tax cut becomes a tax increase. There's no kind of overwhelming impact, but it does consistently mitigate it, and there is variation across the taxes. Mm-hmm. A couple things, that's important to keep in mind that it doesn't do. I mentioned the cyclical aspect. It also doesn't incorporate any administrative aspects to large changes, which would be relevant discussion to have at the policy level. To what extent would the state be affected by difficulties or ease of administration of a new tax? And so to just tie this to the task force, I think Paul mentioned in that document, the task force report, there's an Appendix G that has the output from a number of runs that were done for the task force. And one of the things that we're constantly trying to refine is some sort of standard output for OTIM. We'll also often get requests for an OTIM analysis, and sometimes there is a particular interest in certain aspect. There might be an interest in just the dynamic feedback effect. There might be an interest in the distributional impact for households. And so what you'll find in the Appendix G is an attempt to come up with some at least sort of standard output that we can provide for individuals who don't have specific interest, and that it can at least get the discussion going.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question that will probably betray my ignorance on it. Could OTIM handle a multiple or a series of inputs? In other words, if you created or considered one change or sort of a phased series of changes, if you're doing one and then another one comes in during, I think you mentioned a five-year horizon before the new equilibrium is assumed, can it handle something that's coming along partway through that process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, it's not really designed for, okay, you implement a personal income tax change in year one, and then a corporate income tax change in year two, and then a sales tax or something like that. It really does compare two points in time.
Okay.
So it can handle a myriad of policy changes all at one time, and you'll find some of those examples in the Appendix G. But it really is two points in time. So you have the reality of 2001 as the Oregon economy existed then, and the model would then say, well, what if we changed these five things? Mm-hmm. We input that into the model. We have the static impact. We input that to the model. And then the equations play out. Prices adjust. Supply and demand, they're thrown out of balance with that input. And then throughout all the extensive equations in the model, they're brought back into alignment.
Yep.
And then that's kind of the alternate reality of the impact of those policies.
Thanks.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looks like the model was updated in 2006. Have you had a chance to compare its projections to reality?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, this is a good question and something we talk about often in terms of, okay, well, how well does it make these predictions? It's not really a forecasting tool as opposed to Tom's forecast. You know, he says in 2 years the revenues will be X, and then we catch up with that time, and you can compare the actual with what the forecast was. It really is a comparison of almost kind of the same point in time, if you will, but under two different scenarios. So, and that's why it doesn't get at that cyclical aspect. But we're constantly looking at ways to poke at the model and say, okay, well, are these assumptions correct? Is it valid? Are these elasticities, sorry, the lingo, but some the way producers and households respond to certain things, do we have those correct? Is there new information? Is there new research out there that we can input to the model so that we can tweak it? We are constantly doing those kinds of things.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. So is it correct to say then that this is looking at, let's say, today and saying if we had another system in place, this would be where we are? Or are you actually looking forward to a point, let's say, 5 years out and saying, if we continue on the current model, this is where we are, and if we institute this new idea, this is where we might be? Which is it? Which point in time are we actually looking at?
It's kind of a mixed bag. The model is based on 2001. It's based on real data, and all of those are from 2001. We calibrate the model to whatever year the policy would be changed. So, for example, if you instituted a new policy that started in 2011, some dramatic change. And again, we're talking about it's a big picture tool. So a large change that begins in 2011, we would convert all of the dollars, come back to 2001 dollars, and then put it in the model, and then reconvert it back out to 2011. So from the customer's perspective, if you will, that is kind of transparent. You're talking about a policy change in, say, 2011, and that everything would be discussed in those terms in 2011. Does that get at what you're trying to?
Sure. Well, yes. It illustrates, like Representative Reed, my lack of knowledge about how it works. So I need more time to study it. A lot more.
The computer, the CGE models are.
Yep. Paul.
I'll just get back to what we think it does, or where we think it'll help you in your thinking is. And, you know, I refer to scenario one, which is in your appendix, on a sales tax versus an income tax. And that question we get asked a lot. Well, how would the world be different? And what would an economic model tell us? And I think what it does for you, it tells you the trade-offs. Where would, if we made this change, what is likely to result from that? Well, what the model says is you're likely to have more employment. Consumption tax is less of a deterrent to jobs growth than an income tax. That would generate some in-migration. You would have some additional investment. You'd have lower wages because people would be compensated less because they wouldn't have to cover the income tax. And you would have a higher price level. Sales taxes are built into the price level. And then it tells you that would be a, if you incorporate those economic changes, you would get, even with a revenue-neutral proposal initially, you would get more revenue because there'd be more employment. But it also tells you, when you look at total net household income by income group, which we do in this scenario, that the tax would disproportionately hit low-income people, and the major beneficiaries of that proposal would be households with income above $185,000. So, I mean, those are the kind of trade-offs you can look at. And I think you'll find this, if you look at these major proposals, you know, there's not some magic plan that, gee, this is going to do everything we want it to do. It's mostly going to show you the trade-offs, as, you know, what are the kinds of things that could be improved by this change, what are the kind of things that might be negatives. And that's where we hope that this fits in the policy discussion and help you sort through what some of those trade-offs are. It's not going to be the magic bullet that tells you what to do, but it's just going to inform you in those decisions about what are some of the potential advantages and disadvantages.
Thank you. Let me make an analogy and see if you agree with this. In some ways, it sounds as though you are doing the same kind of experiment that a social scientist would do dealing with a complex system in which you make only one variable change, in this case some kind of tax change, and then you're making an assumption about what the effect of that one thing is going to be on this entire system over a period of time with no other changes in inputs. Nothing else changes, just that one thing. It's a little bit like if a psychologist or another social scientist were trying to run an experiment and trying to control everything else and make one change and predict what the outcome of that experiment was going to be. Now, of course, there are lots of other changes going on all the time in the real world. There are lots of other things happening. The economy we have today isn't exactly the same as the economy we had in 2001. So even the assumptions you make are wrong to the extent that those changes have been made. So I think that it's safe to say, I'm getting head nods, so I appreciate that I must be on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you're probably saying is that you can't predict the actual outcomes that are going to occur, partly because there's so many other variables going on, so many other changes are happening in the economy, other than this tax change. But also, while the effect on the 2001 economy may be accurately stated, the fact that the economy is slightly different than it was in 2001 means that the effects are going to be slightly different. So we should view these reports as kinds of orders of magnitude predictions and direction predictions rather than specific number predictions. Is that a safe thing to say so far?
I think so, Mr. Chair. That's a fair and safe thing to say. It is not a predictive tool. A number of the assumptions, that is a good analogy. We have these levers built in, and we have many levers on the tax side. Depending on the CGE models used, a lot of CGE models are built for a lot of different reasons, and so they're built with different levers. This one focuses on the tax levers. And within those assumptions, there are a lot of assumptions that go into there, and to the extent we can, those are based on other research that has been done elsewhere in other universities, other published research. And so there is variation in the degree to which an assumption exists in terms of, well, we have solid information and it comes from this research, or all we have so far is economic theory, and that's what's driving current economic theory in terms of driving the inputs into some of those assumptions. But it really is that kind of controlled experiment.
Okay, and then a final comment, and I see if you agree with this. It is quite possible that different changes in the economy that come from other sources could overwhelm the effect that any particular change in the tax law might have, if it were large enough.
Yes, I mean, exactly. It's a key assumption that it's comparing these two points in time with just these changes.
Right.
We know that's going to be wrong in reality. Over 5 years, the economy's changed dramatically. Well, for the most, sometimes they're relatively static, but they are going to change. And trying to incorporate every potential change into a model just gets to be overwhelming and dilutes any power of that model.
Right.
And I think the way Paul summed it up is really the key value is the trade-offs. Economics is often about trade-offs,
right?
And this is a way to highlight those in terms from the policy perspective.
Right. And so even if another variable overwhelmed the effect of a tax change, that doesn't reduce the value of understanding the direction that the tax change tends to push things.
Correct. It just creates more challenges for us to tell if the model is correct.
Right. And, yeah, that's true. to measure the validity of the model in the first place.
Exactly.
Then the final question I have, and I think we're going to have to break then pretty quickly. The session is at 10:15 this morning, I believe. If you were to update the model today, what year's data could you use? In 2006, you used 2001. How close to the present time could you get if you were to update it today?
Off the top of my head, I would think 2004, maybe.
Okay.
It's kind of a 4 or 5 year.
4 or 5 year.
And it depends. And part of that, it's driven kind of by the lowest common denominator. There are a variety of tax sources. We use personal income tax data from the Department of Revenue, which 2007 is becoming available now. But that has to be mirrored and lined up with other information that takes longer to put together.
Mm-hmm. And I assume there's some expense involved in updating the model.
Yeah. Yes.
The database for the economy is what's called M-Plan, which is used Actually, our Department of Forestry uses the same data set to look at impact of timber harvests and changes. So it's a nationally developed database for each of the states. And that's kind of the core to it. And then we add on a lot of the tax and public finance data.
Great. Thank you very much. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, just yes. Say we're going to post today for next week. And we have one more on Monday. We did have one more kind of information-based meeting on lottery. Lottery director will be here. And the treasurer will be here to talk about the debt policy advisory report. But then Tuesday we'll start hearing bills. So
right. And you're posting those today.
Yes, be right. Posting those today for next week.
Thank you very much. And with that, we'll see you all tomorrow. We are adjourned.